the 100-odd gaunt horses that had survived both Red Waste and Black Salt Sea. "I ought to have a banner sewn," she thought, as she led her tattered band up along Astapor's meandering river. She closed her eyes to imagine how it would look, all flowing black silk, and on it the red, three-headed dragon of Targaryen, breathing golden flames. A banner such as Rhaegar might have borne. The river's banks were strangely tranquil. The Worm, the Astapori call the stream. It was wide and slow and crooked, dotted with tiny wooded islands. She glimpsed children playing on one of them, darting amongst elegant marble statues. On another island, two lovers kissed in the shade of tall green trees with no more shame than Dothraki at a wedding. Without clothing, she could not tell if they were slave or free. The Plaza of Pride, with its great bronze harpy, was too small to hold all the unsullied she had bought. Instead, they had been assembled in the Plaza of Punishment, fronting on Astapor's main gate, so they might be marched directly from the city once Daenerys had taken them in hand. There were no bronze statues here, only a wooden platform where rebellious slaves were racked and flayed and hanged.
"The good masters place them so they will be the first thing a new slave sees upon entering the city,"
Missandei told her as they came to the plaza. At first glimpse, Dany thought their skin was striped, like the zorsis of Jogos Nahi. Then she rode her silver nearer, and saw the raw red flesh beneath the crawling black stripes. Flies. Flies and maggots. The rebellious slaves had been peeled like a man might peel an apple, in a long, curling strip. One man had an arm black with flies from fingers to elbow, and red and white beneath. Dany reined in beneath him. What did this one do?
He raised a hand against his owner.
Her stomach roiling, Dany wheeled her silver about and trotted toward the center of the plaza and the army she had bought so dear. Rank on rank on rank they stood, her stone halfmen with their hearts of brick, 8,600 in the spiked bronze caps of fully trained unsullied, and 5,000-odd behind them, bareheaded, yet armed with spears and short swords. The ones farthest to the back were only boys, she saw, but they stood as straight and still as all the rest. Krasnys Mor Nakhlas and his fellows were all there to greet her. Other well-born Astapori stood in knots behind them, sipping wine from silver flutes, as slaves circulated among them with trays of olives and cherries and figs. The elder Grasdan sat in a sedan chair supported by four huge copper-skinned slaves. Half a dozen mounted lancers rode along the edges of the plaza, keeping back the crowds who had come to watch. The sun flashed blinding bright off the polished copper discs sewn to their cloaks, but she could not help but notice how nervous their horses seemed. They fear the dragons, and well they might. Krasnys had a slave help her from her saddle. His own hands were full, one clutched his tokar, while the other held an ornate whip.
"Here they are," he looked at Missandei. "Tell her they are hers, if she can pay."
"She can," the girl said.
So Jorah barked a command, and the trade goods were brought forward. 6 bales of tiger skins, 300 bolts of fine silk, jars of saffron, jars of myrrh, jars of pepper and curry and cardamom, an onyx mask, 12 jade monkeys, casks of ink in red and black and green, a box of rare black amethysts, a box of pearls, a cask of pitted olives stuffed with maggots, a dozen casks of pickled cavefish, a great brass gong, and a hammer to beat it with, 17 ivory eyes, and a huge chest full of books written in tongues that Dany could not read, and more, and more, and more. Her people stacked it all before the slavers. While the payment was being made, Krasnys Mor Nakhlas favored her with a few final words on the handling of her troops.
"They are green as yet," he said through Missandei. Tell the whore of Westeros she would be wise to blood them early. There are many small cities between here and there, cities ripe for sacking. Whatever plunder she takes will be hers alone. Unsullied have no lust for gold or gems, and should she take captives, a few guards will suffice to march them back to Astapor. We'll buy the healthy ones for a good price, and who knows, in 10 years some of the boys she sends us may be unsullied in their turn. Thus all shall prosper.
Finally, there were no more trade goods to add to the pile. Her Dothraki mounted their horses once more, and Danny said, "This was all we could carry. The rest awaits you on the ships, a great quantity of amber and wine and black rice. And you have the ships themselves, so all that remains is the dragon," finished the Grasdan with a spiked beard, who spoke the common tongue so thickly. "And here he waits." Sir Jorah and Belwas walked beside her to the litter, where Drogon and his brothers lay basking in the sun. Jiqui unfastened one end of the chain and handed it down to her. When she gave a yank, the black dragon raised its head, hissing, and unfolded wings of night and scarlet. Krasny's monocle smiled broadly as their shadow fell across him. Danny handed the slaver the end of Drogon's chain. In return, he presented her with a whip. The handle was black dragon bone, elaborately carved and inlaid with gold. 9 long thin leather lashes trailed from it, each one tipped by a gilded claw. The gold pommel was a woman's head, with pointed ivory teeth.
"The harpy's fingers," Grasny's named the scourge.
Danny turned the whip in her hand. "Such a light thing, to bear such weight." "Is it done, then? Do they belong to me?"
"It is done," he agreed, giving the chain a sharp pull to bring Drogon down from the litter.
Danny mounted her silver. She could feel her heart thumping in her chest. She felt desperately afraid. Was this what my brother would have done? She wondered if Prince Rhaegar had been this anxious when he saw the usurper's host formed up across the Trident with all their banners floating in the wind. She stood in her stirrups and raised the harpy's fingers above her head for all the unsullied to see. "It is done," she cried at the top of her lungs. "You are mine." She gave the mare her heels and galloped along the first rank, holding the fingers high. "You are the dragons now. You're bought and paid for. It is done. It is done." She glimpsed old Grasdan turn his grey head sharply. "He hears me speak Valyrian." The other slavers were not listening. They crowded around Krasny's and the dragon, shouting advice. Though the Astapori yanked and tugged, Drogon would not budge off the litter. Smoke rose grey from his open jaws, and his long neck curled and straightened as he snapped at the slaver's face. "It is time to cross the Triton," Danny thought, as she wheeled and rode her silver back. Her blood riders moved in close around her. "You are in difficulty," she observed.
"He will not come," Krasny said.
"There is a reason. A dragon is no slave." And Danny swept the lash down as hard as she could across the slaver's face. Krasny screamed and staggered back, the blood running red down his cheek into his perfumed beard. The harpy's fingers had torn his features half to pieces with one slash, but she did not pause to contemplate the ruin. "Drogon!" she sang out loudly, sweetly, all her fear forgotten. "Dracarys!" The black dragon spread his wings and roared. A lance of swirling dark flame took Krasny's full in the face. His eyes melted and ran down his cheeks, and the oil in his hair and beard burst so fiercely into fire that for an instant the slaver wore a burning crown twice as tall as his head. The sudden stench of charred meat overwhelmed even his perfume, and his wail seemed to drown all other sound. Then the plaza of punishment blew apart into blood and chaos. The good masters were shrieking, stumbling, shoving one another aside, and tripping over the fringes of their tow cars in their haste. Drogon flew, almost lazily at Krasny's, black wings beating. As he gave the slaver another taste of fire, Irian Jiqui unchained Viserion and Rhaegal, and suddenly there were three dragons in the air. When Danny turned to look, a third of Astapor's proud, demon-horned warriors were fighting to stay atop their terrified mounts, and another third were fleeing in a bright blaze of shiny copper. One man kept his saddle long enough to draw a sword, but Jogo's whip coiled around his neck and cut off his shout. Another lost a hand to Ricaro's Arak and rode off reeling and spurting blood. Aego sat calmly notching arrows to his bowstring and sending them at Tokar's. Silver, gold, or plain, he cared nothing for the fringe. Strong Belwas had his Arak out as well, and he spun it as he charged.
"Spears!"
Danny heard one Astapori shout. It was Grasdan. Old Grasdan, in his tokar, heavy with pearls.
"On solid! Defend us! Stop them! Defend your masters! Spears! Swords!"
When Ricaro put an arrow through his mouth, the slaves holding a sedan chair broke and ran, dumping him unceremoniously on the ground. The old man crawled to the first rank of eunuchs, his blood pooling on the bricks. The Unsullied did not so much as look down to watch him die. Rank on rank on rank, they stood, and did not move. The guards have heard my prayer.
"Unsullied!"
Danny galloped before them, her silver-gold braid flying behind her, her bell chiming with every stride.
"Slay the good masters! Slay the soldiers! Slay every man who wears a tokar or holds a whip, but harm no child under 12, and strike the chains of every slave you see."
She raised the harpy's fingers in the air, and then she flung the scourge aside.
"Freedom!" she sang out. "Dracarys! Dracarys!"
"Dracarys!"
they shouted back, the sweetest word she'd ever heard.
"Dracarys! Dracarys!"
And all around them, slavers ran and sobbed and begged and died, and the dusty air was filled with spears and fire. Sansa. On the morning her new gown was to be ready, the serving girls filled Sansa's tub with steaming hot water and scrubbed her head to toe until she glowed pink. Cersei's own bedmaid trimmed her nails and brushed and curled her auburn hair so it fell down her back in soft ringlets. She brought a dozen of the queen's favorite scents as well. Sansa chose a sharp, sweet fragrance with a hint of lemon in it under the smell of flowers. The maid dabbed some on her finger and touched Sansa behind each ear and under her chin and then lightly on her nipples. Cersei herself arrived with a seamstress and watched as they dressed Sansa in her new clothes. The small clothes were all silk, but the gown itself was ivory samite and cloth of silver, and lined with silvery satin. The points of the long dagged sleeves almost touched the ground when she lowered her arms, and it was a woman's gown, not a little girl's, there was no doubt of that. The bodice was slashed in front almost to her belly, the deep V covered over with a panel of ornate, Moorish lace in dove grey. The skirts were long and full, the waist so tight that Sansa had to hold her breath as they laced her into it. They brought her new shoes as well, slippers of soft grey doeskin that hugged her feet like lovers.
"You are very beautiful, my lady,"
the seamstress said when she was dressed.
"I am, aren't I?"
Sansa giggled and spun, her skirts swirling around her.
"Oh, I am."
She could not wait for Willis to see her like this.
"He will love me. He will. He must. He will forget Winterfell when he sees me. I'll see that he does."
Queen Cersei studied her critically. "A few gems, I think. The moonstones Joffrey gave her."
"At once, Your Grace,"
her maid replied. When the moonstones hung from Sansa's ears and about her neck, the queen nodded. "Yes. The guards have been kind to you, Sansa. You are a lovely girl. It seems almost obscene to squander such sweet innocence on that gargoyle."
"What gargoyle?"
Sansa did not understand. Did she mean Willis?
How could she know?
No one knew, but her and Marjorie and the Queen of Thorns, oh, and Dantas, but he didn't count. Cersei Lannister ignored the question. "The cloak," she commanded, and the women brought it out. A long cloak of white velvet, heavy with pearls. A fierce direwolf was embroidered upon it in silver thread. Sansa looked at it with sudden dread. "Your father's colours," said Cersei, as they fastened about her neck with a slender silver chain. A maiden's cloak. Sansa's hand went to her throat. She would have torn the thing away if she had dared. "You're prettier with your mouth closed, Sansa," Cersei told her. "Come along now, the Septon is waiting, and the wedding guests as well." "No," Sansa blurted, "no." "Yes, you are a ward of the crown. The king stands in your father's place, since your brother is an attainted traitor. That means he has every right to dispose of your hand. You are to marry my brother, Tyrion." My claim, she thought, sickened. Dantos the Fool was not so foolish after all. He had seen the truth of it. Sansa backed away from the queen. "I won't. I'm to marry Willis. I'm to be the Lady of Highgarden. Please." "I understand your reluctance. Cry if you must. In your place, I would likely rip my hair out. He's the loathsome little imp, no doubt of it. But marry him you shall." "You can't make me." "Of course we can. You may come along quietly and say your vows as befits a lady, or you may struggle and scream and make a spectacle for the stable boys to titter over. But you will end up wedded and bedded all the same." The queen opened the door. Sir Meron Trant and Sir Osmond Kettleblack were waiting without, in the white-scale armour of the king's guard. "Escort Lady Sansa to the Sept," she told them. "Carry her, if you must, but try not to tear the gown. It was very costly." Sansa tried to run, but Cersei's handmaid caught her before she had gone a yard. Sir Meron Trant gave her a look that made her cringe, but Kettleblack touched her almost gently and said, "Do as you're told, sweetling. It won't be so bad. Wolves are supposed to be brave, aren't they?" "Brave?" Sansa took a deep breath. "I am a Stark, yes. I can be brave." They were all looking at her, the way they had looked at her that day in the yard when Sir Boris Blunt had torn her clothes off. It had been the imp who saved her from a beating that day, the same man who was waiting for her now. "He's not so bad as the rest of them," she told herself. "I'll go." Cersei smiled. "I knew you would." Afterwards she could not remember leaving the room or descending the steps or crossing the yard. It seemed to take all her attention just to put one foot down in front of the other. Sir Meron and Sir Osmond walked beside her, in cloaks as pale as her own, lacking only the pearls and the direwolf that had been her father's. Joffrey himself was waiting for her on the steps of the castle sept. The king was resplendent, in crimson and gold, his crown on his head. "I'm your father today," he announced. "You're not," she flared. "You'll never be." His face darkened. "I am. I'm your father, and I can marry you to whoever I like, to anyone. You'll marry the pig boy, if I say so, and bed down with him in the sty." His green eyes glittered with amusement. "Or maybe I should give you to Ilion Payne. Would you like him better?" A heart lurched. "Please, Your Grace," she begged, "if you ever love me, even a little bit, don't make me marry your—" "Uncle?" Tyrion Lannister stepped through the doors of the Sept. "Your Grace," he said to Joffrey, "grant me a moment alone with Lady Sansa, if you would be so kind." The king was about to refuse, but his mother gave him a sharp look. They drew off a few feet. Tyrion wore a doublet of black velvet covered with golden scrollwork, thigh-high boots that added 3 inches to his height, a chain of rubies and lion's heads. But the gash across his face was raw and red, and his nose was a hideous scab. "You are very beautiful, Sansa," he told her. "It is good of you to say so, my lord." She did not know what else to say. "Should I tell him he is handsome? He'll think me a fool or a liar." She lowered her gaze and held her tongue. "My lady, this is no way to bring you to your wedding. I'm sorry for that.
and for making this so sudden and so secret. My lord father felt it necessary for reasons of state, else I would have come to you sooner as I wished. He waddled closer. You did not ask for this marriage, I know, no more than I did. If I had refused you, however, they would have wed you to my cousin, Lancel. Perhaps you would prefer that. He is nearer your age and fairer to look upon. If that is your wish, say so, and I will end this farce. I don't want any Lannister, she wanted to say. I want Willis. I want Highgarden, and the puppies, and the barge, and sons named Eddard, and Bran, and Rickon. But then she remembered what Dantos had told her in the Godswood. Tyrell or Lannister, it makes no matter. It's not me they want, only my claim. You are kind, my lord, she said, defeated. I am a ward of the throne, and my duty is to marry as the king commands. He studied her with his mismatched eyes. I know I'm not the sort of husband young girls dream of, Sansa, he said softly, but neither am I Joffrey. No, she said. You were kind to me, I remember. Tyrion offered her a thick, blunt-fingered hand. Come, then, let us do our duty. So she put her hand in his, and he led her to the marriage altar, where the Septon waited between the mother and the father to join their lives together. She saw Dantos in his fool's motley, looking at her with big round eyes. Sir Balon Swan and Sir Boris Blunt were there in Kingsguard white, but not Sir Loras. None of the Tyrells are here, she realized suddenly. But there were other witnesses aplenty. The eunuch Varys, Sir Adam Marbrant, Lord Philip Foot, Sir Bronn, Jalabarzo, a dozen others. Lord Giles was coughing. Lady Ermisande was at the breast, and Lady Tander's pregnant daughter was sobbing for no apparent reason. Let her sob, Sansa thought. Perhaps I shall do the same before this day is done. The ceremony passed as in a dream. Sansa did all that was required of her. There were prayers and vows and singing, and tall candles burning, 100 dancing lights that the tears in her eyes transformed into 1,000. Thankfully, no one seemed to notice that she was crying as she stood there, wrapped in her father's colours, or if they did, they pretended not to. In what seemed no time at all, they came to the changing of the cloaks. As father of the realm, Joffrey took the place of Lord Eddard Stark. Sansa stood stiff as a lance as his hands came over her shoulders to fumble with the clasp of her cloak. One of them brushed her breast and lingered to give it a little squeeze. Then the clasp opened, and Joff swept her maiden's cloak away with a kingly flourish and a grin. His uncle's part went less well. The bride's cloak, he held, was huge and heavy, crimson velvet richly worked with lions and bordered with gold, satin, and rubies. No one had thought to bring a stool, however, and Tyrion stood a foot and a half shorter than his bride. As he moved behind her, Sansa felt a sharp tug on her skirt. "He wants me to kneel," she realized, blushing. She was mortified. It was not supposed to be this way. She had dreamed of her wedding 1,000 times, and always she had pictured how her betrothed would stand behind her, tall and strong, sweep the cloak of his protection over her shoulders, and tenderly kiss her cheek as he leaned forward to fasten the clasp. She felt another tug at her skirt, more insistent. "I won't. Why should I spare his feelings when no one cares about mine?" The dwarf tugged at her a third time. Stubbornly, she pressed her lips together and pretended not to notice. Someone behind them tittered. The queen, she thought, but it didn't matter. They were all laughing by then, Joffrey the loudest. "Dantos, down on your hands and knees," the king commanded. "My uncle needs a boost to climb his bride." And so it was that her lord husband cloaked her in the colours of House Lannister while standing on the back of a fool. When Sansa turned, the little man was gazing up at her, his mouth tight, his face as red as her cloak. Suddenly, she was ashamed of her stubbornness. She smoothed her skirts and knelt in front of him.
so their heads were on the same level. With this kiss, I pledge my love and take you for my lord and husband. With this kiss, I pledge my love, the dwarf replied hoarsely, and take you for my lady and wife. He leaned forward, and their lips touched briefly. He is so ugly, Sansa thought, when his face was close to hers. He is even uglier than the hound. The Septon raised his crystal high, so the rainbow light fell down upon them. Here in the sight of gods and men, he said, I do solemnly proclaim a Tyrion of House Lannister and Sansa of House Stark to be man and wife, one flesh, one heart, one soul, now and forever, and cursed be the one who comes between them. She had to bite her lip to keep from sobbing. The wedding feast was held in the small hall. There were perhaps 50 guests. Lannister retainers and allies, for the most part, joining those who had been at the wedding. And here Sansa found the Tyrells. Margaery gave her such a sad look, and when the Queen of Thorns tottered in between left and right, she never looked at her at all. Eleanor, Arla, and Megha seemed determined not to know her. My friends, Sansa thought bitterly. Her husband drank heavily and ate but little. He listened whenever someone rose to make a toast, and sometimes nodded a curt acknowledgment, but otherwise his face might have been made of stone. The feast seemed to go on forever, though Sansa tasted none of the food. She wanted it to be done, and yet she dreaded its end. For after the feast would come the bedding. The men would carry her up to a wedding bed, undressing her on the way, and making rude jokes about the fate that awaited her between the sheets, while the women did Tyrion the same honours. Only after they had been bundled naked into bed would they be left alone, and even then the guests would stand outside the bridal chamber, shouting ribald suggestions through the door. The bedding had seemed wonderfully wicked and exciting when Sansa was a girl, but now that the moment was upon her, she felt only dread. She did not think she could bear for them to rip off her clothes, and she was certain she would burst into tears at the first randy jape. When the musicians began to play, she timidly laid her hand on Tyrion's and said, "My lord, should we lead the dance?" His mouth twisted. "I think we have already given them sufficient amusement for one day, don't you?" "As you say, my lord." She pulled her hand back. Joffrey and Margaery led in their place. "How can a monster dance so beautifully?" Sansa wondered. She had often daydreamed of how she would dance at her wedding, with every eye upon her and her handsome lord. In her dreams they had all been smiling. Not even my husband is smiling. Other guests soon joined the king and his betrothed on the floor. Eleanor danced with her young squire, and Megha with Prince Tommen. Lady Merryweather, the Moorish beauty with the black hair and the big dark eyes, spun so provocatively that every man in the hall was soon watching her. Lord and Lady Tyrell moved more sedately. Sir Kevin Lannister begged the honour of Lady Jenna Fossaway, Lord Tyrell's sister. Mary Crane took the floor with the exiled Prince Jalabar Zo, gorgeous in his feathered finery. Cersei Lannister partnered first Lord Redwine, then Lord Rowan, and finally her own father, who danced with smooth, unsmiling grace. Sansa sat with her hands in her lap, watching how the queen moved and laughed and tossed her blonde curls. She charms them all, she thought dully. How I hate her! She looked away to where Moonboy danced with Dontus.
Lady Sansa!
Sir Garland Tyrell stood beside the dais.
Would you honour me, if your lord consents?
The imp's mismatched eyes narrowed.
My lady can dance with whomever she pleases.
Perhaps she ought to remain beside her husband, but she wanted to dance so badly, and Sir Garland was brother to Margaery, to Willis, to her Knight of Flowers. I see why they name you Garland the Glancer, she said, as she took his hand.
My lady is gracious to say so. My brother Willis gave me that name, as it happens, to protect me.
To protect you? She gave him a puzzled look. Sir Garland laughed.
I was a plump little boy, I fear, and we do have an uncle called Garth the Gross. So Willis struck first, though not before threatening me with Garland the Green Sick, Garland the Galling, and Garland the Gargoyle.
It was so sweet and silly that Sansa had to laugh, despite everything. Afterward, she was absurdly grateful. Somehow, the laughter made her hopeful again, if only for a little while. Smiling, she let the music take her, losing herself in the steps, in the sound of flute and pipes and harp, in the rhythm of the drum, and from time to time in Sir Garland's arms, when the dance brought them together. "My lady wife is most concerned for you," he said quietly one such time. "Lady Leonette is too sweet. Tell her I'm well." "A bride at her wedding should be more than well." His voice was not unkind. "You seemed close to tears."
"Tears of joy, sir."
"Your eyes give the lie to your tongue." Sir Garland turned her, drew her close to his side. "My lady, I have seen how you look at my brother. Loras is valiant and handsome, and we all love him dearly. But your imp will make a better husband. He is a bigger man than he seems, I think."
The music spun them apart before Sansa could think of a reply. It was Mace Tyrell opposite her, red-faced and sweaty, then Lord Merryweather, then Prince Tommen.
"I want to be married too,"
said the plump little princeling, who was all of 9.
"I'm taller than my uncle."
"I know you are," said Sansa, before the partners changed again. Sir Kevin told her she was beautiful. Jalabar Zur said something she did not understand in the summer tongue, and Lord Redwine wished her many fat children and long years of joy. And then the dance brought her face to face with Joffrey. Sansa stiffened as his hand touched hers, but the king tightened his grip and drew her closer.
"You shouldn't look so sad. My uncle is an ugly little thing, but you'll still have me."
"You're to marry Margaery."
"No king can have other women. Whores. My father did. One of the Aegons did too. The third one, or the fourth. He had lots of whores and lots of bastards."
As they whirled to the music, Joff gave her a moist kiss.
"My uncle will bring you to my bed whenever I command it."
Sansa shook her head. "He won't."
"He will, or I'll have his head. That King Aegon, he had any woman he wanted, whether they were married or no."
Thankfully, it was time to change again. Her legs had turned to wood, though, and Lord Rowan, Sir Tallard, and Eleanor Squire all must have thought her a very clumsy dancer. And then she was back with Sir Garland once more, and soon, blessedly, the dance was over. Her relief was short-lived. No sooner had the music died than she heard Joffrey say,
"It's time to bed them. Let's get the clothes off her, eh? And have a look at what the she-wolf's got to give my uncle."
Other men took up the cry loudly. Her dwarf husband lifted his eyes slowly from his wine cup.
"I'll have no bedding."
Joffrey seized Sansa's arm.
"You will, if I command it."
The imp slammed his dagger down in the table, where it stood quivering.
"Then you'll serve us your own bride with a wooden prick. I'll geld you, I swear it."
A shocked silence fell. Sansa pulled away from Joffrey, but he had a grip on her, and her sleeve ripped. No one even seemed to hear. Queen Cersei turned to her father. "Did you hear him?" Lord Tywin rose from his seat.
"I believe we can dispense with the bidding. Tyrion, I am certain you did not mean to threaten the king's royal person."
Sansa saw a spasm of rage pass across her husband's face.
"I misspoke," he said. "It was a bad jape, sire."
"You threatened to geld me,"
Joffrey said shrilly.
"I did, your grace," said Tyrion, "but only because I envied your royal manhood. Mine own is so small and stunted."
His face twisted into a leer.
And if you take my tongue, you will leave me no way at all to pleasure this sweet wife you gave me."
Laughter burst from the lips of Sir Osmond Kettleblack. Someone else sniggered, but Joff did not laugh, nor Lord Tywin.
"Your Grace," he said, "my son is drunk. You can see that."
"I am," the imp confessed, "but not so drunk that I cannot attend to my own bedding."
He hopped down from the dais and grabbed Sansa roughly.
"Come, wife, time to smash your portcullis. I want to play Come Into the Castle."
Red-faced Sansa went with him from the small hall. "What choice do I have?" Tyrion waddled when he walked, especially when he walked as quickly as he did now. The guards were merciful, and neither Joffrey nor any of the others moved to follow. For their wedding night, they had been granted the use of an airy bedchamber high in the Tower of the Hand. Tyrion kicked the door shut behind them.
"There is a flagon of good Arbor gold on the sideboard, Sansa. Will you be so kind as to pour me a cup?"
"Is that wise, my lord?"
"Nothing was ever wiser. I am not truly drunk, you see, but I mean to be."
Sansa filled a goblet for each of them. "It will be easier if I am drunk as well." She sat on the edge of the great curtained bed and drained half her cup in three long swallows. No doubt it was a very fine wine, but she was too nervous to taste it. It made her head swim.
"Would you have me undress, my lord?"
"Tyrion,"
he cocked his head. "My name is Tyrion, Sansa."
"Tyrion, my lord, should I take off my gown, or do you want to undress me?" She took another swallow of wine. The imp turned away from her.
"The first time I wed, there was us and a drunken septon and some pigs to bear witness. We ate one of our witnesses at our wedding feast. Taisha fed me crackling, and I licked the grease off her fingers, and we were laughing when we fell into bed."
"You were wed before. I had forgotten."
"You did not forget. You never knew."
"Who was she, my lord?" Sansa was curious, despite herself.
"Lady Taisha," his mouth twisted, "of House Silverfist. Their arms have one gold coin and 100 silver upon a bloody sheet. Ours was a very short marriage, as befits a very short man, I suppose."
Sansa stared down at her hands and said nothing.
"How old are you, Sansa?" asked Tyrion after a moment.
13, she said, "when the moon turns."
"Gods have mercy." The dwarf took another swallow of wine. "Well, talk won't make you older. Shall we get on with this, my lady, if it please you?"
"It will please me to please my lord husband." That seemed to anger him.
"You hide behind courtesy as if it were a castle wall."
"Courtesy is a lady's armor," Sansa said. Her scepter had always told her that.
"I am your husband. You can take off your armor now."
"And my clothing?"
"That too."
He waved his wine cup at her.
"My lord father has commanded me to consummate this marriage."
Her hands trembled as she began fumbling at her clothes. She had 10 thumbs instead of fingers, and all of them were broken. Yet somehow she managed the laces and buttons, and her cloak and gown and girdle and undersilk slid to the floor until finally she was stepping out of her small clothes. Goose prickles covered her arms and legs. She kept her eyes on the floor, too shy to look at him, but when she was done, she glanced up and found him staring. There was hunger in his green eye, it seemed to her, and fury in the black. Sansa did not know which scared her more.
"You're a child," he said.
She covered her breasts with her hands.
"I flowered."
"A child," he repeated.
"But I want you. Does that frighten you, Sansa?"
"Yes."
"Me as well. I know I'm ugly."
"No, my lord." He pushed himself to his feet.
"Don't lie, Sansa. I am malformed, scarred, and small, but—"
She could see him groping.
"A bed, when the candles are blown out."
I am made no worse than other men. In the dark, I am the knight of flowers. He took a draught of wine. I am generous, loyal to those who are loyal to me. I've proven I'm no craven, and I am cleverer than most. Surely wits count for something. I can even be kind. Kindness is not a habit with us Lannisters, I fear. But I know I have some, somewhere. I could be good to you. He is as frightened as I am, Sansa realized. Perhaps that should have made her feel more kindly toward him, but it did not. All she felt was pity, and pity was death to desire. He was looking at her, waiting for her to say something, but all her words had withered. She could only stand there trembling. When he finally realized that she had no answer for him, Tyrion Lannister drained the last of his wine. "I understand," he said bitterly. "Get into the bed, Sansa. We need to do our duty." She climbed onto the feather bed, conscious of his stare. A scented beeswax candle burned on the bedside table, and rose petals had been strewn between the sheets. She had started to pull up a blanket to cover herself when she heard him say, "No." The cold made her shiver, but she obeyed. Her eyes closed, and she waited. After a moment, she heard the sound of her husband pulling off his boots and the rustle of clothing as he undressed himself. When he hopped onto the bed and put his hand on her breast, Sansa could not help but shudder. She lay with her eyes closed, every muscle tense, dreading what might come next. Would he touch her again? Kiss her? Should she open her legs for him now? She did not know what was expected of her. "Sansa!" The hand was gone. "Open your eyes." She had promised to obey. She opened her eyes. He was sitting by her feet, naked. Where his legs joined, his man's staff poked up stiff and hard from a thicket of coarse yellow hair, but it was the only thing about him that was straight. "My lady," Tyrion said, "you are lovely, make no mistake. But I cannot do this. My father be damned. We will wait. The turn of a moon, a year, a season, however long it takes, until you have come to know me better, and perhaps to trust me a little." His smile might have been meant to be reassuring, but without a nose, it only made him look more grotesque and sinister. "Look at him," Sansa told herself. "Look at your husband. At all of him. Septim Ordain said all men are beautiful. Find his beauty. Try." She stared at the stunted legs, the swollen, brutish brow, the green eye and the black one, the raw stump of his nose and crooked pink scar, the coarse tangle of black and gold hair that passed for his beard. Even his manhood was ugly, thick and veined, with a bulbous purple head. "This is not right. This is not fair. How have I sinned that the gods would do this to me? How?" "On my honor as a Lannister," the imp said, "I will not touch you until you want me to." It took all the courage that was in her to look in those mismatched eyes and say, "And if I never want you to, my lord?" His mouth jerked, as if she had slapped him. "Never?" Her neck was so tight, she could scarcely nod. "Why," he said, "that is why the guards made whores for imps like me." He closed his short, blunt fingers into a fist and climbed down off the bed. Arya. Stony Sept was the biggest town Arya had seen since King's Landing, and Harwin said her father had won a famous battle here. The Mad King's men had been hunting Robert, trying to catch him before he could rejoin your father, he told her as they rode toward the gate. He was wounded, being tended by some friends, when Lord Cunnington, the Hand, took the town with a mighty force and started searching house by house. Before they could find him there,
Lord Eddard and your grandfather came down on the town and stormed the walls. Lord Connington fought back fierce. They battled in the streets and alleys, even on the rooftops, and all the septons rang their bells so the small folk would know to lock their doors. Robert came out of hiding to join the fight when the bells began to ring. He slew 6 men that day, they say. One was Miles Mouton, a famous knight who had been Prince Rhaegar's squire. He would have slain the hand, too, but the battle never brought them together. Connington wounded your grandfather Tully sore, though, and killed Sir Dennis Arran, the darling of the Vale. But when he saw the day was lost, he flew off as fast as the griffins on his shield. The Battle of the Bells, they called it after. Robert always said, your father won it, not him. More recent battles had been fought here as well, Arya thought from the look of the place. The town gates were made of raw new wood. Outside, the walls a pile of charred planks remained to tell what had happened to the old ones. Stony Sept was closed up tight, but when the captain of the gate saw who they were, he opened a sally port for them. "How are you fixed for food?" Tom asked as they entered. "Not so bad as we were. The huntsman brought in a flock of sheep, and there's been some trading across the Blackwater. The harvest wasn't burned south of the river. Course, there's plenty want to take what we got. Wolves one day, mummers the next. Them that's not looking for food are looking for plunder or women to rape. And them that's not out for gold or wenches are looking for the bloody Kingslayer. Talk is, he slipped right through Lord Edmure's fingers."
"Lord Edmure?" Lem frowned. "Is Lord Oster dead, then?"
"Dead or dying. Think Lannister might be making for the Blackwater?"
"Huh? It's the quickest way to King's Landing, the huntsman swears."
The captain did not wait for an answer.
"He took his dogs out for a sniff round. If Sir Jamie's hereabouts, they'll find him. I've seen them dogs rip bears apart. Think they'll like the taste of lion blood?"
"A chewed-up corpse is no good to no one," said Lem. "The huntsman bloody well knows that, too. When the Westermen came through, they raped the huntsman's wife and sister, put his crops to the torch, ate off his sheep, and killed the other half for spite. Killed 6 dogs, too, and threw their carcasses down his well. A chewed-up corpse would be plenty good enough for him, I'd say. Me as well."
"It best not," said Lem. "That's all I've got to say. It best not, and you're a bloody fool."
Arya rode between Harwin and Angai as the outlaws moved down the streets where her father had once fought. She could see the sept on its hill, and below it a stout, strong holdfast of grey stone that looked much too small for such a big town. But every third house they passed was a blackened shell, and she saw no people.
"Are all the town folk dead?"
"Only shy," Angai pointed out 2 bowmen on a roof, and some boys with sooty faces crouched in the rubble of an alehouse. Farther on, a baker threw open a shuttered window and shouted down to Lem. The sound of his voice brought more people out of hiding, and Stony Sept, slowly, seemed to come to life around them. In the market square at the town's heart stood a fountain in the shape of a leaping trout, spouting water into a shallow pool. Women were filling pails and flagons there. A few feet away, a dozen iron cages hung from creaking wooden posts.
Crow cages, Arya knew.
The crows were mostly outside the cages, splashing in the water or perched atop the bars. Inside were men. Lem reined up, scowling.
"What's this now?"
"Justice,"
answered a woman at the fountain.
"What, did you run short of hemp and rope?"
"Was this done at Sir Wilbert's decree?" asked Tom.
A man laughed bitterly.
"Huh? The lions killed Sir Wilbert 1 year ago. His sons are all off with the young wolf, getting fat in the west. You think they give a damn for the likes of us? It was a mad huntsman caught these wolves."
"Wolves?" Arya went cold. "Rob's men and my father's." She felt drawn toward the cages. The bars allowed so little room that prisoners could neither sit nor turn. They stood naked, exposed to sun and wind and rain. The first three cages held dead men. Carrion crows had eaten out their eyes, yet the empty socket seemed to follow her. The fourth man in the row stirred as she passed. Around his mouth, his ragged beard was thick with blood and flies. They exploded when he spoke, buzzing around his head.
"Water!"
The word was a croak.
"Please! Water!"
The man in the next cage opened his eyes at the sound.
"Here!" he said. "Hear me!"
An old man he was. His beard was grey, and his scalp was bald and mottled brown with age. There was another dead man beyond the old one, a big red-bearded man with a rotting grey bandage covering his left ear and part of his temple. But the worst thing was between his legs, where nothing remained but a crusted brown hole crawling with maggots. Farther down was a fat man. The crow cage was so cruelly narrow it was hard to see how they'd ever gotten him inside. The iron dug painfully into his belly, squeezing bulges out between the bars. Long days, baking in the sun, had burned him a painful red from head to heel. When he shifted his weight, the cage creaked and swayed, and Arya could see pale white stripes where the bars had shielded his flesh from the sun. "Whose men were you?" she asked them. At the sound of her voice, the fat man opened his eyes. The skin around them was so red, they looked like boiled eggs floating in a dish of blood.
"Water! A drink!"
"Whose?" she said again.
"Pay them no mind, boy," the townsman told her. "They're none of your concern. Ride on by."
"What did they do?" she asked him.
"They put 8 people to the sword at Tumbler's Falls," he said. "They wanted the Kingslayer, but he wasn't there, so they did some rape and murder."
He jerked a thumb toward the corpse with maggots where his manhood ought to be.
"That one there did the raping. Now move along."
"A swallow,"
the fat man called down.
"Have mercy, boy, a swallow."
The old one slid an arm up to grasp the bars. The motion made his cage swing violently.
"Water!"
gasped the one with the flies in his beard. She looked at their filthy hair and scraggly beards and reddened eyes, at their dry, cracked, bleeding lips. "Wolves," she thought again, "like me." Was this her pack? How could they be Rob's men? She wanted to hit them. She wanted to hurt them. She wanted to cry. They all seemed to be looking at her, the living and the dead alike. The old man had squeezed 3 fingers out between the bars.
"Water!"
he said.
"Water!"
Arya swung down from her horse. "They can't hurt me. They're dying." She took her cup from her bedroll and went to the fountain.
"What do you think you're doing, boy?"
the townsman snapped.
"They're no concern of yours."
She raised the cup to the fish's mouth. The water splashed across her fingers and down her sleeve, but Arya did not move until the cup was brimming over. When she turned back toward the cages, the townsman moved to stop her.
"You get away from them, boy."
"She's a girl," said Harwin. "Leave her be."
"Aye," said Lem. "Lord Beric don't hold with gauging men to die of thirst. Why don't you hang 'em decent?" "There was nothing decent about them things they did at Tumbler's Falls,"
the townsman growled right back at him. The bars were too narrow to pass a cup through, but Harwin and Gendry offered her a leg up. She planted a foot in Harwin's cupped hands, vaulted onto Gendry's shoulders, and grabbed the bars on top of the cage. The fat man turned his face up and pressed his cheek to the iron, and Arya poured the water over him. He sucked at it eagerly and let it run down over his head and cheeks and hands, and then licked the dampness off the bars. He would have licked Arya's fingers if she hadn't snatched them back. By the time she served the other two the same, a crowd had gathered to watch her.
"The Mad Archman will hear of this,"
a man threatened.
"He won't like it. No, he won't."
"He'll like this even less, then." Angai strung his longbow, slid an arrow from his quiver, knocked, drew, loosed. The fat man shuddered as the shaft drove up between his chins, but the cage would not let him fall. Two more arrows ended the other two Northmen. The only sound in the market square was the splash of falling water and the buzzing of flies. Velar Magullus, Arya thought. On the east side of the market square stood a modest inn with whitewashed walls and broken windows. Half its roof had burned off recently, but the hole had been patched over. Above the door hung a wooden shingle painted as a peach, with a big bite taken out of it. They dismounted at the stable, sitting catty-corner, and Greenbeard bellowed for grooms. The buxom red-haired innkeep howled with pleasure at the sight of them, then promptly set to tweaking them.
"Greenbeard, is it? Or Greybeard? Mother take mercy! When did you get so old? Lem, is that you? Still wearing the same ratty cloak, are you? I know why you never wash it, I do. You're afraid all the piss will wash out, and we'll see you're really a knight of the King's Guard. And Thomas Sevens, you randy old goat, you come to see that son of yours. Well, you're too late. He's off riding with that bloody huntsman. And don't tell me it's not yours."
"He hasn't got my voice," Tom protested weakly.
"He's got your nose, though, aye, and t'other parts as well, to hear the girls talk."
She spied Gendry then, and pinched him on the cheek.
"Look at this fine young ox. Wait till Alice sees those arms. Oh, and he blushes like a maid, too. Well, Alice will fix that for you, boy. See if you don't."
Arya had never seen Gendry turn so red.
"Tansy, you leave the bull alone. He's a good lad," said Tom Sevenstrings. "All we need from you is safe beds for a night."
"Speak for yourself, singer." Angai slid his arm around a strapping young serving girl as freckly as he was.
"Beds we got," said red-haired Tansy. "There's never been no lack of beds at the pitch, but you'll all climb in a tub first. Last time you lot stayed under my roof, you left your fleas behind."
She poked Greenbeard in the chest.
"And yours was green, too. You want food?"
"If you can spare it, we won't say no,"
Tom conceded.
"Now when did you ever say no to anything, Tom?"
"Huh?"
The woman hooted.
"I'll roast some mutton for your friends, and an old dry rat for you. It's more than you deserve. But if you gargle me a song or three, might be I'll weaken. I always pity the afflicted. Come on, come on. Cass, Lanner, put some kettles on. Jazine, help me get the clothes off them. We'll need to boil those, too."
She made good on all her threats. Arya tried to tell them that she'd been bathed twice at Acorn Hall not a fortnight past, but the red-haired woman was having none of it. Two serving wenches carried her up the stairs bodily, arguing about whether she was a girl or a boy. The one called Helly won, so the other had to fetch the hot water and scrub Arya's back with a stiff, bristly brush that almost took her skin off. Then they stole all the clothes that Lady Smallwood had given her and dressed her up like one of Sansa's dolls, in linen and lace. But at least, when they were done, she got to go down and eat. As she sat in the common room in her stupid girl clothes, Arya remembered what Cyrio Forel had told her, the trick of looking and seeing what was there. When she looked, she saw more serving wenches than any inn could want, and most of them young and comely. And come evenfall, lots of men started coming and going at the peach. They did not linger long in the common room, not even when Tom took out his wood harp and began to sing Six Maids in a Pool. The wooden steps were old and steep, and creaked something fierce whenever one of the men took a girl upstairs. "I bet this is a brothel," she whispered to Gendry.
"You don't even know what a brothel is."
"I do so," she insisted. "It's like an inn with girls." He was turning red again.
"What are you doing here, then?" he demanded. "A brothel's no fit place for no bloody high-born lady. Everybody knows that."
One of the girls sat down on the bench beside him.
"Who's a high-born lady? The little skinny one?"
She looked at Arya and laughed.
"I'm a king's daughter myself."
Arya knew she was being mocked.
"You are not."
"Well, I might be."
When the girl shrugged, Her gown slipped off one shoulder.
They say King Robert fucked my mother when he hid here back before the battle. Not that he didn't have all the other girls, too, but Leslin says he liked my ma the best.
The girl did have hair, like the old king's, Arya thought. A great thick mop of it, as black as coal.